Hello and welcome back for the final session before the lunch break. The British Library's done a lot of talking about itself for the last two or so hours, so we're going to hand over to the real world. As I mentioned, we've got a strong relationship with the Beggars Group and Beggars Archive, in thanks largely to Leslie's hard work and Andy. So we thought, what better to offer a real-life record label into the building to talk with one of the best young journalists in the country, Rory Gibb. So this is a Q&A for the next 40 minutes or so. Over to you.
Hello? Hello? Am I on? Oh, that's amazing. I can't actually tell. Cool. Thank you, everybody. Yeah, my name's Rory Gibb. I'm one of the editors of the Quietus music website. And this is Leslie Bleakley from Beggars Group, who is the director of archive and catalogue there. I think for how long have you been?
I've been at Beggars Group for 25
how
years.
How long have you been doing that role for, I mean?
Since last April, so just under a year. So I just came back from Vietnam where I was working remotely, and then this whole new position was kind of created as we're getting a mature independent label, shall I say. And some members of staff were getting rather mature. So it seems time to do some archiving.
So Beggars was founded in 1977, right?
Yeah.
So you've got basically well over 30 years worth of material to be kind of sifting through in a way.
And it's a lot. And, you know, as any, particularly I think with independent labels, you start off, you know, in 1977, there's probably three people working. I mean, we've probably got global business now with about 200 people. So over the years, everything's grown. And as a record label, all you do is think to the future, the next release, the promotion, what's going on next. So I know there's a lot of criticism as to why you're looking. We had this room, basically, at the end of the road where people shoved things. And that was our archive. It was unbelievable. It was mouldy. It smelt. It was full of kind of rubbish and obviously some very, very valuable things as well. And I think, you know, it was to come into this role to be asked to, A, even look in that room, never mind sort it out, is quite daunting. But I understand the longer I've done this, why people don't, in the music industry, which is a very forward-thinking industry, don't think about archiving more. And I think I forgive ourselves a lot more than I used to at the beginning, because I think some major things have happened. Up until the last few years, we were just releasing and we were releasing. We obviously did catalogue of our classic albums, but as this vinyl resurgence happened, it's gone deeper into the catalogue. And I think you get to the point where you're like, well, we haven't got the masters. We can't find the artwork. Where the bloody hell are the photos? I mean, and it's become more of a common theme throughout the people in the company. We can't find anything. And then obviously that leads you to think, well, we need to get more organised. We need to go back into what we've done before. And we need to digitise. And obviously the digital scale of things is just phenomenal. So I think there's a convergence of quite a few different areas that have sort of brought us to this point. And me coming back after being in Vietnam for 4 years, not working in the music industry, only remotely, I think it's also given me quite a good perspective as well. I've been out of it and not just been delved in it. And I think now I can just look and think, this is what we need to do. And I've been given time to do research, which has been the best 3 months, really, has been to sit and do research, particularly on dam systems and all the various aspects that you need to even think about undertaking something like this. Because obviously there's the physical archiving and there's the digital archiving, and they are very different.
So, I mean, you've kind of mentioned things like the vinyl resurgence and kind of, I guess, becoming aware increasingly now of this of needing to be conscious of your archive. I mean, when your position was created, like, why did it become kind of obvious that it was the right time to start doing this now? As opposed to 5 years ago or something, you know, like are there any particular conditions that meant that now would seem like the right time
archiving as such has become kind of a key word in the industry. I've read a lot of press, certainly of Atlantic Records in New York. You know, sales have gone down and everyone's panicking and running around like headless chickens. Oh my God, the industry's over. So I know there's been quite a lot of press, and there was a really good piece in the New York Times with Atlantic Records, and they've basically gone back into their archive and they've looked and they've found all these fabulous things from years ago and suddenly they've sold, and then people started thinking, well, oh God, this is the way we're going to keep the industry going. So I think it's been a, you know, I think it's been a thing that's been sort of bubbling around for a year, but a few years, sorry. And I just feel it's just the right time. Mm. I mean, the vinyl thing, I think we all thought it would last a year. I'm not sure anyone thought it was going to be what it is now. In fact, every year everyone's like, is this going to carry on? Is it really going to carry on? And every year it does. And every year, well, we better delve a bit deeper. Mm. So, and I think there's something very, that we like as human beings. I think we're tactile. I think we like having things. I'm excited. I've just been newly asked to do catalogue as well. So I'm very excited about doing really special packaging. I mean, that, I can't wait to get started on that kind of stuff, other than just reissuing vinyl in, you know, heavy vinyl and stuff, but actually doing packages and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's the way that the industry's gone. It's matured. We've got to a point where, again, I mean, I can't say it any more than everyone's running around like headless chickens, not necessarily in our sector, but in other areas of the industry.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, it's reached a point where it feels like it's necessary to start considering, yeah.
And, you know, next year is, what, the 40th anniversary of punk. I mean, we're all getting older, aren't we, so.
I mean, you mentioned the sort of, the room where everything got kind of chucked. I mean, what kind of, if any, I mean, obviously, Beggars was, yeah, sort of, I guess, set up in that kind of punk era, you know, and has been involved with an awful lot of labels over the years.
Yes.
I mean, has there been any real attention paid whatsoever to kind of keeping any kind of organised archive beyond just going, oh, well, I guess it will probably be useful to have these sometime, maybe we'll lob them in a room, you know, like, was there any structure there?
Yeah, there was. I mean, it's not unfair to say there wasn't. Steve Webben, who has worked with Martin since the beginning, they knew each other at in Oxford, he, thank God for Steve, he's one of those people, everything's up here, nothing's written down, it's kind of difficult to do his job, but he's not rudely calling him a train spotter, but he was very, very keen right from the early stages of making sure he's kept two copies of everything at home. So he's got a very, very good archive of just the releases we've done. But he also understood that we needed to keep master tapes. So he's done his best. And each label, whoever's run that label, has been, you know, you get very proud of what your release has kept. The physical copies of vinyls and singles. So on that side of things, we've got those. It's the master tapes that's the problem, because back in the day when people didn't have a lot of money, you used a master 2-inch tape, you recorded your album, and then you recorded over it. And we're missing some crucial albums on master tape, because that's what used to happen, because people didn't have the money to continue back in those days. So, you know, it makes you want to cry when you realise you haven't got everything you want. But at the same time, the actual archiving of the releases has been very well done. It's all in very different places, and I think this is the first time everything's going to be put together, mm-hmm. and we actually can really see what we've got, what we haven't got. And I think the most important thing is what we've not got at this point. And, you know, there's been cases of studios closing down. I mean, I was talking to Andy. I mean, obviously, there's been skips with things thrown into that people have contacted Andy and said, oh, my God, there's all this stuff in a skip, where a studio doesn't want to keep things anymore. So, it's just going to be a process of, I like to think I'm a bit of a completist, but having started doing this job, I'm like, if I can get the best I can get, that's as good as it's going to get. We're never going to have everything.
Mm. I mean, when you started this role, doing this and kind of trying to bring all this into line and kind of structure it, I mean, what kind of, how big did the challenge kind of facing you seem, you know, when you first kind of were faced with sort of the quantity of stuff you were having to process?
I'm still not over it, really. I still every time, oh my God, what have I done? You've got to do it in sections.
Mm.
You know, coming into this, I wanted to do physical and digital. At the moment, I'm just doing physical, because the needs be, we wanted to get rid of the lease on this weird little space we had. We're actually now going to build our own physical archive. So we've just been given planning permission not far from our main office in Wandsworth, to knock down some old garages, and we're actually going to physically build our own. So that was obviously the really driving force of starting on the physical, because we need to do racking, we've got to do temperature control, we've got to do gas in case there's a fire. You know, there's all these things that I'd never considered before, and have learned about. So that really gives us the impetus to make sure that the physical stuff is ready. We've got a massive storage space at the moment in Merton, and I've got two temporary people in there literally going through. We've just closed down three or four sites, put everything in, and we're not ready yet. We've got another 780 two-inch tapes that are stored in Taunton that we haven't collected yet. But once that's done, and Rough Trader, who've got some cages in Camden, that's basically everything together. And that's when we can actually do the proper archiving. Mm-hmm. And that's when we just, you know, alphabetize everything, get it onto racks, see what formats we have, see what duplicates we've got. We've been doing videos. And again, back in the day when you used to have international licensees and there wasn't the digital transfers we have now, if you did a promo video, Prodigy is a prime example. Smack my bitch up. And everybody needed the promo video, so it was sent via mail or courier. And then it got sent to the TV station, and then it got sent back. We've now got, I think, one full box just of duplicates of that particular track. Mm. So, you know, again, it's the process of where we've gone as an industry when we had no digital resources to do things. And from that point of view, it's changed. And it's great. I mean, it saves money, it saves resources, and, you know, just for, you know, environment and everything. But now we've got the problem of trying to recycle all this stuff that we don't need. So, yeah, it's huge. But I think you've just got to do it section by section. With two-inch master tapes are probably the least used, because we don't normally remaster, as in remix. The half-inch and quarter-inches are used the most, so we've got those out first. Mm. So it's what the demand is within the office and what people need. Because obviously, you know, commercials need stems, and, oh, it could go on forever. But I think you just got to do section by section.
Do you kind of have a sense for how, like, targets, or a sense for kind of how long it's going to take you to kind of fully assemble a sort of physical archive?
Yeah, I mean, the building itself is probably going to, well, they've said a year to 18 months, which means at least 2 years, 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. I've got a target of 3 to 4 years. But I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, and looking digitally, which is very, very different to the physical. I think the physical we can get done within 3 years. Digitally is a whole new area because we want to digitize a lot. And it's not, you know, it costs a lot of money to get things digitized. So therefore, you have to prioritize. You go through the labels, the top sellers, get those digitized first. Then we want to get back and store Dizzy Rascal playing in, I don't know, Sweden at a festival. We've got the rights to all those live footage. So we need to get that back, get that digitised as the radio sessions. Not BBC's great, because obviously we've just done a deal with BBC as part of AIM, which is Association of Independent Music. So we've now got access to Peel sessions. Don't have to worry about the BBC, but any of the other channels, we need to get back and digitise and make it available for everybody that works for our labels, and then eventually that'll be for public consumption.
That's a kind of colossal quantity.
It's enormous. It's enormous. I mean, I don't think that part of it is in my lifetime, truthfully. Mm. I think even just going forward, we're going to be easy, but trying to go back is really where the problems are.
I mean, reflecting back on what I think someone was saying earlier in an earlier talk, like, how do you decide in that kind of case what's pertinent to save? You know, I mean, presumably, you know, the artists that the labels work with over the years have generated like a colossal amount of music.
And yes.
I mean, do you just store all of it? Do you just kind of go, well, this will be of use in the future for somebody?
Yeah, because you never know what's going to happen. I mean, again, it's part of the catalogue job. I mean, I get license requests daily from, I mean, some artists. I mean, I really know the catalogue well, but there's a couple of artists I hadn't heard of right back in the day, but people are interested. I mean, you know, and I can license stuff, so we do need to have everything. Mm-hmm. Now, whether we digitise everything or we just digitise as things are requested, I think, obviously, again, looking at I hate the word priorities, but unfortunately, you do, it's still a business. We have to look at the biggest sellers at this point, and all the Adeles and the White Stripes and, you know, the Pixies and all those. We have to look at those and make sure all those catalogues are digitised and stored and maintained. And then it goes down to, you know, I want to do everything. I do want to do everything. Mm-hmm. But whether that is going to be possible, and listening to you talk, I mean, 15 years, I don't know, we're going to get that done in 15 years? I don't think so. It's certainly nowhere near along the lines of the quantities that the British Library have, but I think what we've got is different mixes, we've got edits, and there's so many different varieties within just one album, and there's so many different pieces of that one album that I think the formatting and what you keep, it's going to be an ongoing conversation. Mm. I don't think we can explain it any more than it's an ongoing conversation with what we keep and what we keep everything, what we digitise and what we preserve is going to be a very different thing to just having something on a shelf.
You kind of touched on something that that obviously is kind of a real central aspect of what you're doing, which is obviously you are a commercial organisation.
Yes.
As opposed to, say, the British Library Archive. Yeah. I wonder how you sort of feel that actually that, how you feel that impacts on what you're doing, you know, to what extent you see the archiving process as feeding into that in a way, you know, or kind of to what extent that defines your approach.
I don't know what you mean.
Sorry. Okay.
I can say that again. Like,
so you're a commercial organisation, so yes. Your interests as a business are quite different,
yes,
from the British Library.
Our business is copyright. If we don't have copyright, we don't have a business. So mm-hmm. We've got to preserve what we've got copyright to. Yeah. So, yeah, okay.
But, I mean, presumably you also have to consider, you have, say, limited funds to do this.
Yes.
You have to consider what's kind of most, you know, to what extent do you see the archiving as actually being good for your kind of commercial interests? You know, like, how can you use your archive to actually almost generate more yourself?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think using the archive, I mean, it's discovering new things. I mean, I would like my legacy, you know, when I finish in the next 15 years of Beggars, I would like to do a kind of museum. I mean, that's what I'd like to do. I mean, finding handwritten notes by the Pixies, I get all excited, and it's been absolutely fascinating going through all that stuff and the amount of promo product and tchotchkes and, you know, all the pieces of product you send out to try and promote a record. I'd love to do something like that. So I think there's an element of, I'm very proud of working for a label for a long time, and I'm very proud of our history. So I want to make sure at the end of all of this that there's some public way to celebrate that. But obviously working with the British Library, I'm also very conscious that I lived in America for 14 years and Vietnam for 4 years. I haven't lived in England for 18 years. And I actually, coming back, I've realised how proud I am of English music and the heritage here, and that's why I was very keen to talk to Andy quite early on, because I think the heritage of what we've got here is very important. And as I think as you get older, you look back more, and it's all that kind of stuff. So I think it's both a commercial and a heritage historical thing that has to be sort of blended together, really. Mm-hmm. And I think you can do both.
Something which you kind of mentioned, public accessibility, and obviously that's what I'm quite, obviously you work on sort of reissuing,
yeah,
things and stuff like that, which I come to in a minute, but you talk about, say, setting up a museum for, you know, physical kind of artifacts,
yes,
or whatever, you know, like heritage history. I kind of wonder with I suppose the advent of new digital technologies, given the kind of the subject of the day, like to what extent you could envisage, when you have a digital archive, maybe making, what kind of way you could digitally make that archive open to the public, you know, whether there would be,
God,
whether you're envisaging all of these kind of ideas.
Yeah, I haven't got that far yet. I mean, but is that going to be necessary as such? Because, I mean, you can get everything on Spotify, you know, as streaming gets bigger and bigger, people's access to whatever we do is so much easier now than it was, you know, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be interesting to see whether we're going to need that at that point, because it's almost sort of there. As far as, I mean, there's always going to be things, because again, we are commercial, there's always going to be things, there's demos of classic albums, there's always going to be things that we want to release that we do need to commercially make release, to release commercially, that you don't want just everyone to have free access to, because otherwise we're not going to be able to stay in business. But it's an interesting question, but I think that's going to be an ongoing thing. It's going to be interesting to see where things go. It's always a pull between limiting what people can have and wanting them to have everything, and how we make that a business in the middle.
It must be interesting in general, doing, I suppose, archiving, you know, pop music really now at a time when,
yeah,
actually there is this kind of almost infinite archive of I suppose quite scatty information available out on the internet. I mean, do you kind of, I suppose, see your role in a way with what you're doing as creating like something that's very much like a sort of solidified kind of thing versus what's otherwise very much a disseminated kind of history of your labels?
Yeah, exactly. It's got to be something that we curate, that we keep, because it's only about us. At this point, what we're doing is only about us, mm-hmm. and it has to be done. I mean, talking about with digital, I mean, it's all out there. Is it at the, you know, it's only at 16 bits, so is it the quality is good, and, you know, we want to do everything in 24, who knows what the next thing is going to be. You know, I mean, we have a responsibility to the artists we signed and the sound quality to make sure that, again, digitising and archiving our stuff is as best and in the best way that we can do it, because a streaming system is not going to care about that as much as we are. So there's certain things that as a label you've got to do and you want to do that makes it kind of unique to what we're doing versus it being scattered all over the internet and accessible and, you know.
So the kind of, I wanted to go on to sort of some of the technical aspects, maybe.
Oh,
of...
God, please don't.
No, don't worry. I don't know enough about the actual hardline technical stuff to ask you any real questions. But I'm interested, I guess, you know, like obviously you've been in contact with Alex and Andy here about for advice about how to go about doing this. I mean, so you're saying that you've essentially got your physical archive more or less. You just need to organise it.
Yes.
So the conversations you've been having with the British Library has been about digitising that archive, is that right?
Or no, I mean, even cataloguing the physical. How do you catalogue? What parts of the, you know, I mean, the master tape, quite often the tracks listed on the master tape are not the ones that end up on the release because artists change names of tracks, they change album titles. There's mixes on there that we don't know. Were they the ones that ended on the end? You know, they're the ones that ended on the actual physical release. So there's quite a lot of variety just in that sort of physical side of things that... It's difficult to try and pull off the information you need. You've got to try and make it sort of idiot-proof. You've got to think in 20 years, when somebody who'd started at Beggars needs something, goes back, can they find out everything they need off that tape? It's really difficult because we need engineers to listen to the tape to get all the information off. Are we going to give them too much information? It's sort of like that. It's working about the necessaries that you need versus too much information, which makes it so dull and so unaccessible that no one's ever going to use it. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about things like that. It's talking about, again, I mean, the British Library, you couldn't get, you know, it's a temperature... I didn't know about bloody temperature control a year ago. You know, I mean, I didn't know, understand oxidising. Baking, I thought, was for cakes, not for tapes. You know, but I have learnt so much in a year. I mean, and again, things like just, I get quite proud when I tell people in the office, oh, no, we can't have a sprinkler system. It's got to be gas. And everyone's like, oh, why? Because it's, you know, it's things like you can't have water on your tapes. And there's so much to learn. And again, having the resources of just talking to Andy and Alex about what they do, because they're the experts in it. I'm no expert. I'm just learning off the back of the other people. You know, and Jackie at EMI Archive in Hayes, again, absolutely brilliant in the BBC. But I think I've had to go out there and find out all this stuff. And Abbey Road, again, we do a lot of work with them, and they've been really good too. About, you know, giving the information, because we're a label. We didn't know we had to do any of this stuff. We still don't really know we have to do any of this stuff, but we do. Mm. And I think now everybody's realised that we do. And it's been invaluable talking to people about this stuff because, again, I came into this thinking, oh, my God, we can get rid of all that shit and we're going to digitise everything. That was my absolute, you know, I am so neat and tidy. I don't want any of those crappy tapes anywhere. That's how I thought when I was asked to do this. I've done 360. I'm like, oh, my God, digitising, there's corrupted files. You know, my daughters look at me and go, who the hell are you? You know, it's fascinating. And I think the one thing I'm so fed up of people thinking archiving is dusty and boring. It's absolutely fascinating. And it's historical and it's really exciting. And it's really useful. Mm-hmm. It's really useful. And it is preservation. And it's, I don't know. I think it's great. And I wouldn't have said that a year ago.
Do you think you sort of mentioned like the EMI archive and yeah. And Abbey Road and things like that? I mean, to what extent do you think there's been consciousness of the need to archive across sort of music industry wide? You know, I mean, it sounds like you guys maybe are some steps ahead of other you know labels or yeah. institutions in doing it, but I mean, has there been a wide kind of awareness of the need to do this?
Well, again, when I was doing research, the only place that I really could find online through the Google searches was the EMI archive, mm-hmm. and they've been so helpful and so open to talking to us about it. The V&A, I never actually managed to get in there, always wanted to, but I didn't get the invitation. But again, have been very good about sending documentation about the film. The film side versus the audio side, that kind of blows my mind, but there you go. I've got to have to deal with that at some point. But they've been really useful in doing that. And again, the BBC. Other than that, I suppose I only researched so far, got the information I needed, got the contacts, and, you know, I've got this lovely group of people now that we kind of talk and we do those kind of things. I haven't gone any further than that, but as a very instant Google search, I didn't find a lot.
No. That's interesting.
So I don't know what that says.
Yeah. Maybe it's sort of lots of people doing it quietly in-house, you know.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Possibly. And I think, you know, we're all going, what the hell do we do? You know, I mean, future-proofing, there is no future-proofing. You know, the head archivist at Abbey Road said, if you want to future-proof it, you carve it in stone. And he's right. That's the only way. There's no future-proofing. And we're all looking for future-proofing. I'm really pleased to hear that you're only looking 15 years ahead. Because I'll be off then, so I'll be done. Won't have to worry after that. But it is. You've just got to future-proof as much as you can, but we just don't know what's coming in the future. So it makes it exciting from frustrating all at the same time.
Mm. That was something I wanted to ask about, really, was kind of future-proofing in general, really. I mean, is there anything you kind of can do at the moment or that you are doing to kind of try? I suppose you were talking about like temperature controlled spaces and things like that, but you know.
Yeah, it's as good as it gets. And building our own archive. I mean, I think having the resources to do that, a lot of independent labels don't. And I think, again, that's why I was talking to Alex. I'm going to certainly talk to a lot of the independents through the AIM membership to talk about, you know, making sure the British Library do have things, because a lot of small independents don't have the resources. And some won't, and some that get bigger will. But I think we're very lucky we can do that. That's what we're going to do. I mean, at least with the physical, I've got 760 or 80 tapes coming from Taunton. Once they're in, that's it. There'll be no more. There might be the odd studio that closes down that suddenly goes, oh, my God, what's all this crap? Let's send it back to the label. But on the whole, that's it, because no one's recording on 2 inches anymore. So it's a finished format, and that makes it easier. It makes it easier to alphabetize without having to worry about spaces and moving everything along. It makes it easier to see what you've got. Everything now, obviously, for the last 10-odd years, things have been coming on hard drives. Our A&R people have not been very, shall I say, what's the word I'm looking for? Good at making sure that we get the hard drives. And worrying about where the master is. I think it was a bit different in the past. Well, actually, it wasn't different in the past. The studios had the 2 inches, and it was only the physical space that made them go, oh, my God, I've got to get rid of this lot. Let's send it back to the labels. A&R people are not good about thinking about the past. They're one of the future. But catalogue keeps a label going. 60% of our business is catalogue. Something is a catalogue piece after a year. Mm. Some people say it's less than that. You know, in next year, the XX will be considered, the first album will be catalogue. Adele's first album will be catalogue. So you've got to think, it's trying to educate very creative A&R people that this is important without them glazing over going, oh, it's archive, history, don't care, you know. Mm. So it's an ongoing education process.
I mean, you talk about kind of catalogue, and that was, I suppose, one of the other things I wanted to talk about was obviously reissues and box sets and all this kind of stuff seem very much to be in demand at the moment in general. I mean, with the archive that you've got, I mean, how do you go about deciding what to reissue? Or, I mean, are you kind of involved in that decision-making process?
That's my new job, and that's a hard one. Because everyone's like, oh, let's reissue this. I don't know. I think there's obvious holes. Steve that did the catalogue reissues until he retired in December, his focus was very much the early Gary Newmans, the Nephilim. That was his kind of era. Mine's a little bit more recent than that. I'm looking at Corner Shop and Lush and Badly Drawn Boy, those things that probably haven't been done. I think whoever does the job, I think there's a certain point where you grew up with the music, you work with the artist, you know what the artist is like, you know what is going to be possible and what's not going to be possible with managers and all those kind of things. So I think that's where you sort of start off. And also what's in the market, what's, you know, what people are interested in. You know, everything's cycles, isn't it? Mm. It's cycles of music. I mean, God bless Gary Newman, but his career just goes on and on and on. And it's, you know, without him, we wouldn't be a label. So it's, you know, and it's talking to the artist as well. Mm. I mean, we talk, I mean, again, I love working with artists that are what we call catalogue. Oh, God, I hate that word, but the more mature artists that have been through the ringer, because there's no egos anymore and it's just a proper grown-up conversation, and that's what's been really good. And we're having really good talks with various people about what they want to do. Mm. And then you've got to weigh it up with the commercial aspects, as we do with everything. But it's just a very fluid, you know, at the moment I'm going through the holes and seeing what we've not got in vinyl stock. I mean, that's kind of dull, but that's what we really need to do. Because this vinyl fad isn't going anywhere, is it?
No.
So just making sure we've got everything in stock and available, really, on the vinyl side of things. And then really, I mean, this year's been my setup year, making sure we've got digital catalogue, making sure we've got the mail order sorted, all those kind of very basic things. Next year, I think it's going to be the fun year of doing some really intricate box sets with some fabulous packaging, and that's what I'm looking forward to getting stuck into.
And so, I guess with kind of, you know, more curios from the archive,
yeah,
kind of in
yeah, exactly, in there, and as we're discovering things as well, yeah. There's an anniversary's coming up. That's always a one, you know. I feel it's a bit overdone, the whole anniversary thing, but it's still very relevant. And we've got some anniversaries coming up of certain artists. You can't believe, oh my God, was that really 20 years ago? But that, all that sort of, so it also creates its own system of when you release things and what you do with it.
You mentioned kind of discovering bits as you go along. I mean, just kind of as an aside, really. I mean, like, has it been interesting going through kind of the physical archive, and have you found kind of odd, interesting little things that you kind of wouldn't really have expected to be in there?
Not quite yet. Not quite on the scale of, what was it, David Bowie, those unrecorded things that we found. I was hoping for something like that, but we haven't got that. We actually have got some weird tapes. We've got some Wham tapes that were sent to us by accident. They're on eBay. there's been interesting things like that, but no, not yet. And again, we only started this a few months ago, so we are so... We're so in the early stages of finding things. I mean, the photos have been fabulous. I mean, all we do is go, oh my God, they look so young. But there's so much good. I'm looking forward to doing the photographs. I think that's going to be a really interesting part. And going through artwork and stuff like that, but we're nowhere near at that stage yet. So, ask me in a couple of years.
I guess kind of lastly, really, I wanted to just ask a little bit about... so, obviously, the music that you're putting out now, the new music you're putting out now, is all kind of digital formats, you know, presumably, is that all kind of almost being archived by default now, in a way? You know, or are you kind of...
No, it's not. No, it's not. Because, I mean, again, digital CDs is 16-bit. Mm. Not good enough. It's not good enough. I mean, master tape, it's got to be 24/96. So, and again, getting the A&R people to remember to give me things to put on a system. Don't even get me on storage. What the hell are we going to do with the storage? We're going to have internal... My idea was internal systems for regular masters, because audio is not too bad. There's the capability, you know, the amount that you need to store. When you get into raw, uncompressed videos, oh, I mean, we haven't even gotten there yet. I mean, I'm having an argument with the IT guys at the moment. I'm like, deep stuff on cloud and keep other stuff in. Because, you know, these SAN and these systems, they're thousands and thousands of pounds for all these terabytes of stuff to use. So, God, that sounded techie and boring, didn't it? Sorry. But, you know, you do have to... start thinking about that. And people say that the thing's on the cloud, is it, you know, you've got to keep paying for it? Do you really own it if it's on the cloud? And there's this whole debate going on.
You need to buy your own, like, offshore server rig or something.
Yeah, that ain't going to happen. But, you know, that's the other thing that we've got to think with the digital. But again, because the physical thing really at the moment is the primary concern because of building and stuff, we've not really gone to the digital, other than we've got a big sound system that I upload things to when I can get my hands on the actual masters before it's mastered, if that makes sense. You know, the recordings from the studio before it gets mastered. That's what I want. Once it's been mastered and on CD, yes, it all gets filed. But to be honest with you, I'm not interested in that. I want the actual, the tracks, because I need to get instrumentals, we need to get the stems, you know, because obviously all video games, you need stems and stuff from. So once it's been mastered and released...
That's the point where it's not really of,
it's not
of
interest
anymore.
To me. And yes, that automatically gets archived because it goes into an extranet system for everyone to use and blah, 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 all that. But I need the stuff before that. And that's the hardest thing to get hold of at this point.
Great. I don't really know how we're doing for time, but I was...
I think it's questions.
Huh? Yeah, I was going to say, that's what I thought, yeah. So,
sorry, I always talk too much, don't I?
has anybody got any questions?
Have you ever been able to get any missing content back from an external library like the British Library?
Haven't tried yet. Can I? the reason why is because I don't know what we're missing at this point. We actually have never, and I do think if that is possible, which I don't think we've ever talked about, it would be quite useful for labels to know things are here. I mean, I actually buy things off Discogs. I mean, I've actually bought quite a few things off Discogs that were missing, just on the, you know, the physical releases. I hadn't actually thought maybe I could have asked you to borrow.
It has happened in the past.
I hadn't thought of that.
Recordings and artwork as well, where people have lost the original artwork for sleeves, and we got a pristine sleeve, and we can scan
them. I will be doing, yes.
What proportion of your archive by bulk, roughly, would you say is tapes and audio, and what proportion is paperwork? Have you kept paperwork through the ages? What is your policy with regard to paperwork, contracts, session logs, correspondence, minutes?
Dotted around Beggars, which is, it's an old building that we keep buying bits of, so it's like a rabbit warren. There are more filing cabinets than I can possibly tell you, and there's paperwork in there. When we cleared out the top, there was correspondence of like marketing plans going back. I kept relevant ones, but to be honest with you, life was just too short to go through everything. Contracts wise, we're okay, probably not for the early stuff, but we were very, very aware that if we found the Lurkers contract, obviously we want to keep it. But over the last, I would say, last 10, 15 years, we've been very, very good at scanning and keeping things in. I haven't even got into that part yet. And actually, I don't want to. That's someone else's problem. But I know what you're saying, and it is very, it's again, as you start doing this, you think, oh, it's just a little bit, but it can go so deep. But I think we're not too bad on things like that. And obviously, accounts are kept for 7 years, and then they're scrapped. So...
Hi, I'm Will Prentice, also from the British Library. You said a couple of things, Leslie, which I was very pleased to hear. First of all, in a time when a lot of people are a bit intimidated by the fact that stuff is disappearing and archives are mouldy rooms that people don't like to go into, you're quite energised and enthusiastic about the opportunities that the archiving offers you. So that's really nice to hear. Also, you mentioned that you've been able to get advice from the British Library and from EMI Archive and so on. So forming a kind of network is often quite difficult among archivists because they're sometimes a little bit insular. So that's really encouraging as well. And I just wanted to mention to anybody else in the room that the British Library is very happy to offer advice or direct you towards sources of information and so on. It's one of the things that we do as well as archiving your stuff. We also help out in any way that we can, basically, with information or directing you to places. So do get in touch with us if you're interested. There's also an organisation called British and Irish Sound Archives, or BISA as they're known, which is just a kind of semi-informal group of archivists, public and private sector, who are able to organise and coordinate things between each other, exchange information and just find ways forward and things. So I think there's an awful lot for the public and private sector archives to learn from each other that isn't often acknowledged enough. So it's great to hear you and to hear hopefully other similar stories later on today. And do stay involved. Thanks.
I really enjoyed that Q&A, and to hear you eloquently speak about beggars was really good. It struck me.
I didn't think I was eloquent, but whatever.
It struck me that there were three types of archives that you're describing, actually. There was the commercial archive, then there's the organisation's archive and histories itself, and then the third one is the wider cultural archive and the impact that beggar and its artists and its fans, and fans aren't often talked about enough. You know, they'll definitely hold some missing materials for you, has had on the broader cultural heritage of the UK, and you mentioned it a bit earlier about, you know, being proud of the UK's music heritage. And it strikes me that the third aspect of archiving popular music is often missing. So my question is, do you consider the wider importance of beggars' cultural heritage, and how do you or can you balance your commercial interests with the cultural interests, or isn't it even a concern for you?
Oh, it is a concern, definitely. It's we've been very fortunate. We've kept going for a long time. I mean, Martin Mills, who owns it, I mean, he's an amazing person to work for, but no, he's incredibly smart. But on top of that, there's been luck. There's been, if Gary Newman hadn't had that hit in America with Cars, we'd have been under. We wouldn't be here now. So there's a certain element of the unknown of what happens. The other organisation I didn't mention that I've got quite involved with is the British Music Experience. I visited them a few times and I'm helping them. They're doing various exhibitions and introducing them to like the Prodigy's manager, because they want the Prodigy to do some talks about, you know, the 1994 and beyond and those kind of things. I think because we've got mature at this point and we're coming up to our 40th anniversary, I think you do then have the amount of artists to feel that we were part of something. I think if you're a younger label, you haven't quite got to that stage yet. But it's very much a concern. And I have no idea if this museum thing will ever take shape. Everyone thinks I'm a bit mad. But I just thought it'd be really nice to do something. So it's always on the back of my mind. I just love this heritage, this idea of heritage. And again, living in America, oh God, they're so proud of everything they do. And we're not, and we should be. And I think, you know, one of our biggest exports, I think the years I was over there, I think the biggest export other than steel was music. And obviously Adele had a huge blip on that, but this is prior to Adele. And I was always very proud of, not being English as such, but very proud of being different. And I think that was part of my growing up within the industry and running an English label in America, and being patted on the head a lot and told to, yeah, go away. And, you know, but I think that's sort of made, I think we need to be a lot prouder of what we've achieved musically for such a small country. So it's very much on my mind. So, and I'm just trying to get people in the office, again, not to glaze over when I chat to them about it. So, yeah, I hope that answers that question.
One sort of rambling question that picks up on the issue of fans. A lot of fans dedicate a lot of their time to their own, creating their own websites with bootleg material, etc. In my own case, I'm an archivist of South African jazz, and if you look at Gallo in South Africa, who control 80% of the music that is written there, they're in complete chaos. So, you know, a lot of the work that a lot of us put into archiving stuff privately is of value for the heritage. But I suppose my question to you as beggars, how do you deal with fans that have got content that you want, and how do you broker those relationships?
Again, haven't got to that stage yet. And it's a really good question, actually, because I have been thinking about that. I don't know what we're going to do. I mean, I mean, 4AD fans are beyond fans. I mean, they're incredible. And I think you've just got to engage with people. I mean, so we're not exclusive. We just happen to be the label. And I think we need to do everything we need to do for our artists and our company and create that. I have thought about we need to engage with the Uber fans and we need to make them feel part and parcel of this. How we do that, I don't know. I mean, obviously, we've got the Facebook sites. You know, there's all the social media aspects that we all work with. I mean, in the future, we are going to have to think about what they've got, what we've got, how we meld that together and make it. I just think it's just important to have it sort of not in one place solely, but at least have one body of work that everybody can access. And then everybody's going to go off in their little spirals of what they're interested in and what they own and what, you know, or what they recorded off John Peel back in 1979 or whatever. That's fine. I can't worry about all that stuff, can I? I mean, I've got enough to do as it is here. But I do think once we get to that point, we do need to really start thinking about how we engage everybody else, because it's music, it's culture, it's not ours, it's everybody's, isn't it? So, but we've got to always got to be careful of our copyrights. What can I say? What can I say?
That's a good note there to finish. Yeah. Okay, thanks for all the questions. Thanks to Leslie and Rory. That's really interesting. Okay, so it's lunchtime now. So go and grab yourself some lunch, and we'll be back at 1:25 for a legal deposit in Norway and new ways of archiving recorded music.